In this episode of Flying Smarter, I'm taking a look at one more great use for global entry and talking about the aircraft type that has lavatories on the cargo hold level. Then, for the main segment, aviation writer, photographer, and video producer Joey Girardi joins me to talk about the United States Essential Air Service. We'll talk about what it is, what flights are like, why it's so important, and much more. Welcome to episode 42 of Flying Smarter, the podcast that explores the fascinating worlds of air travel to help you become a smarter and savvier traveler. Let's get started. To start off this week, I won't be addressing a new question, but instead want to follow up on what I talked about regarding global entry in the last episode. To recap, Global Entry is a U.S. government trust traveler program, and it allows pre-approved travelers to go through expedited screening and processing when going through U.S. Customs and Border Protection when entering the United States. It also comes with TSA PreCheck, allowing you to get expedited security screening in the U.S. as well. Now, since the publication of that episode, a listener sent in a message with a great point. Here's what he had to say.
In regards to Global Entry ID, the biggest use of the card that I've seen is it substitutes quite well for a real ID.
This is a great addition to what we talked about, and it's something that I didn't mention, so thank you for sending this in. For a bit of context, the Real ID Act of 2005 was introduced in response to the 9/11 Commission, which presented recommendations to prevent future attacks after September 11th. The Act essentially sets out minimum standards for state-issued identification cards like driver's licenses and included things like record checks to verify an individual's identity and physical security features in the card itself. The idea was that Real ID compliant identification would be required for domestic air travel and access to federal facilities and nuclear power plants. The requirement was initially supposed to be implemented in 2008, but this deadline has constantly been pushed back. Most recently, it was moved from May of 2023 to May of 2025, mostly because of state government delays and backlogs in issuing Real ID compliant cards due to the COVID-19 pandemic. That being said, enforcement of the requirement is already in place at some federal facilities. So how does Global Entry play a role in all this? Well, like our listener said, a Global ID card can be used in place of Real ID compliant identification. The Transportation Security Administration, or TSA, outlines acceptable documents that can be used for ID when flying in the US, and there are some others in addition to state-issued ID. Department of Homeland Security trusted traveler cards, like Global Entry cards and Nexus cards, are on the list, as are things like passports and permanent residence cards. Over the past decade, you've probably seen and heard the warnings about the upcoming Real ID deadline since it keeps getting pushed, but if you have a Global Entry card, when the requirement does come in place for air travel, this isn't something that you'll have to worry about. Another thing that I want to mention is that it's relatively easy to lose your Global Entry or your Nexus privileges. Since you're considered a trusted traveler, the tolerance for making mistakes at the border is pretty low. I personally remember that during my interview, I was told that the program was zero tolerance. My guest from episode 30, flight attendant Lara Ketterman, talks more about this and shares a story in a recent episode of the podcast that she co-hosts, Non-Rev Lounge. It's episode 34 of their podcast, and you can check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Did you know that there's a type of aircraft where there are lavatories on the cargo hold level below the main cabin? The Airbus A340-600 is a super long aircraft, and German carrier Lufthansa has found a creative way to use the extra cargo hold space. The economy class lavatories on their A340-600s have downstairs lavatories. There's a staircase that goes down from the main level into a small waiting area with 5 lavatories. There's also a small galley downstairs with an elevator that can move catering carts between the two levels. This allows the airline to put in more seats on the main deck and to use up extra space in the cargo hold. I've actually been on one of these planes and gone downstairs to use the lavatory, and it's very unique to see. Joey Girardi is an aviation writer, photographer, and videographer. He's a writer at Airline Geeks, an aviation news site, and has a special interest in small airlines and airports in the United States. Joey documents and shares his travels through photography and video production. He's an airline employee and holds a degree in aviation operations and management. I don't think I've seen anyone as passionate about regional flying and the essential air service as Joey, and so I'm super happy to have him here. Joey, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks. I look forward to talking with you about essential air service, and I, like you said, it's a very fun topic to talk about for me, so I can't wait to discuss it with you.
Maybe let's start from the very beginning then. What is the essential air service?
All right. So essential air service came about with the Airline Deregulation Act in 1978. It granted airlines the ability to determine what routes and cities they wanted to serve and at what price in the United States. Many of the cities, smaller cities around the country, worried that they would lose air services now it wasn't as heavily regulated. And this is when the EAS program was introduced. It's a clause of the Airline Deregulation Act. It's part of it. And it basically just guarantees that small cities are going to have continued access to air service so that people can use it for much needed travel to smaller cities that are off the beaten path.
Right. So I understand that EAS, right, is in place to provide service to airports where perhaps it wouldn't be commercially viable, like you discussed. How do airports become eligible, or how do they lose eligibility, or how does all that work?
So becoming eligible and losing eligibility are two. One of them is way easier than the other. Becoming eligible, for the most part, in 2023, or even just within the past 10 years, most of the airports that already qualify for the Essential Air Service program are already in the program. So you're not going to be seeing many airports joining the program. But there are quite a few ways which they can lose eligibility. There are three main requirements to be an Essential Air Service city. The first one is the airport cannot have a per passenger subsidy rate of $200 or more, unless you're more than 200 miles driving miles away from the nearest medium or large airport. So basically, everywhere in the US, you have to follow the $200 subsidy cap unless you're in Alaska. You know, most of those cities are pretty far away from any major airport. The second one is, well, in the program, you have to have an average of 10 passengers, or what they call enplanements per day. You have to average 10 or more a day in order to continue qualifying for the EAS funding. And the third one, and this is the biggest one and what qualifies most of the cities, is that the community has to be more than 70 miles away from the nearest medium or large sized airport. And this is a big thing of what the EAS program is about, is what makes the airports essential is that they're so far away from these larger airports that they need the service. And that's why this distance is the big requirement for most of these cities. They did add a clause in about 2000, 2001, somewhere around there. Before, it was just 70 miles. But the new rule is that it's 70 highway miles away, or highway miles, or the most used route from the nearest medium or large airport. The 70 highway miles, or, you know, 70 most drivable miles from the medium or large hub, there are airports, and there are going to be airports that face this rule that currently don't. Muskegon, Michigan, currently, they are, you know, obviously over 70 highway miles. They are 100 drivable, most driven route from Detroit, and they're 180 miles from Chicago O'Hare. You know, those are both medium or large size airports. But they're only about 48 miles from Grand Rapids. Grand Rapids is a big airport. It's not a hub, but, you know, it's a very busy airport. And they're not that far away from it. They're less than a 40-minute drive away from this larger airport. And this is really one of those interesting cases where, obviously, COVID was a horrible thing for the industry and for everybody. But COVID actually saved Muskegon and their subsidy eligibility. Grand Rapids was about to hit that medium-sized airport threshold in 2020-2021. If the passenger numbers continued to grow at the rate they were. Right. But with COVID, passenger numbers dropped all over the industry, all over the world. And that saved Muskegon from becoming ineligible, because once Grand Rapids hits that medium-sized airport threshold, they are no longer eligible in the EAS program.
So it's not even that the airport itself sees any changes that where they could lose eligibility. It could be the other airports around it where that change. Eh?
Right, exactly. It could be an outside factor. And there's not many of these airports. Off the top of my head, I think Muskegon is the only one currently that is at this risk. Because most of these airports are quite a distance away from any other large airport. There are EAS cities that are, you know, close distance to other EAS airports, but that's not the rule. You have to be a certain distance from a medium or large airport.
Right.
And that, like I said, at this point in time, I believe Muskegon is the only one that faces this threat right now.
Now, I know one of the things that you like covering is changes in EAS contracts, the airlines that get them, the new ones, whoever lost an EAS contract, for example. How do the contracts and the subsidization actually work?
So that's a very good question. And I'm going to give you the abridged version.
Okay.
Basically, when a contract is nearing its expiration, say it's going to expire on December 31st of, you know, 2023 or whatever. Couple months before, the DOT will put out a document requesting proposals from airlines that wish to serve this airport, and then they will have a certain amount of time, whether it's, you know, a month or 2 months or 3 months, it really depends on the situation, to submit these documents, and they'll say, hey, you know, submit your proposal, and then airlines will submit a document. You know, sometimes it's one airline, sometimes it's multiple airlines. Some cities have, you know, three or four, sometimes even five airlines submitting proposals for the service where they list, you know, the subsidy they wish, what, you know, marketing they're going to do, the service they're going to do, the aircraft, you know, all that type of stuff. And then what happens after they submit those is the DOT will then say, okay, we're going to put out this request for comments, and then people from the community and, you know, I guess anywhere, because now it's published online, they will give you this email and they say, all right, you have, you know, 1 or 2 months, whatever it may be, to submit your comments or your thoughts you have on this route and which airline you want to be chosen and why. And, you know, some of these comments will be pages long from the town board or the homeowners association or something in one of these smaller cities. But, you know, some of these comments will be more on the funnier side, and you'll just get an email from John Doe that just says Newark sucks, don't serve Newark. And somebody's email simply just, I saw a document once. It was just an email from some person. It just said, don't do Newark, it sucks. And that's all the email said. So, you know, you can send in comments like that, or you could give actual reasons. And then once those comments are in, that comment period closes, then it's up to the DOT to choose what airline they want to serve that community. And they could choose for many different reasons. They may choose the cheapest airline. They may choose whatever airline the most people want, you know, the majority of people want. But it is truly up to the DOT who they choose. The process can last anywhere from 6 to 8 months. So this process starts way, way before the current contract is supposed to expire under normal circumstances. You know, there are expedited versions of this when SkyWest requested to terminate 29 cities. You know, they said, okay, airlines, you have 2 weeks to submit an application. They submitted an application. All right, you have a week and a half to submit comments. So, you know, there are very abridged and expedited versions of this, but for the most part, that doesn't happen.
Yeah. Now, on the note of bidding and the sort of the awarding of the contracts process, like, who are the main players in the EAS system? Like, what are the airlines that are involved?
For the most part, the same airlines are always involved. And over the years, these main players do change. You know, back in 2014, 2015, the main players were Great Lakes Airlines. You know, they're gone, so they're no longer a player. SkyWest is a big player right now, but, you know, they're becoming less of a large player. Even just 2 years ago in November of 2020, SkyWest had, between the United branded and the Delta branded service, SkyWest held 40, 45 contracts. And, you know, now they hold, I'd say, 30 to 35 between the two airlines. So SkyWest has always kind of been a big player, especially in the past 10 years or so since Great Lakes went away. Boutique Air they're San Francisco based. They fly 8-seat Pilatus PC-12s, and they did fly King Air 350s as well, but that's since gone. After Great Lakes went out of business, they did pick up a lot of Great Lakes cities. I want to say 90 to 95% of Great Lakes cities they picked up. So for a while, they were the main player. And you just kind of see that shift slowly from one airline to the next on who these big players will be, Great Lakes, boutique. And we're kind of seeing another shift. Like I said, in November of 2020, the top players in this were, SkyWest, Cape Air, and Southern Airways Express. SkyWest had, 45 to 50, whatever I said, contracts. Cape Air had, 18 or so around the country, and then Southern Airways Express had 13. SkyWest still at the top, but they have less, 35 to 40 between the Delta and the United branded. But now we have Contour. They went from 6 EAS contracts in 2020 to now having 20. And they've grown a lot in the past couple of years, and even in the last, 8, 9 months, they're starting three new cities on August 1st, 2023. So you see airlines like Contour with the 30-seat jet build up this service and become a massive player. Southern Airways Express still in third place, but they went from 13 to 19 contracts. And that was with consolidation of a couple airlines too. Mokulele, they held three contracts in Hawaii and one in California. Southern Airways merged with them. Air Choice One, they held three or four contracts in the Midwest. Southern bought them. So you kind of do see consolidation not only with the large airlines like Northwest, Delta, US Airways, American, but you still see airline consolidation in the smaller side of things as well, not just for larger airlines. It does happen.
Now, when travelers are flying, what can they expect when they're flying in the EAS system in terms of aircraft type, or even the passenger experience?
That really just kind of depends on not only the airline, but the length of the route. In Alaska itself has, 65 to 70 EAS cities in the state alone, because Alaska is giant. Most of the cities aren't near or even connected to the road system. But, Alaska, the routes are longer. So you see routes like Anchorage to Adak Island was at one point the longest EAS route. It's just over 4 hours. It's on a major airline and it's on a mainline aircraft. It's on a 737. So it's, the service is comparable to that on an Alaska airline flight in the lower 48. You get the normal Alaska airline service, you get the snacks and all that stuff. But then you go on planes like Southern Airways and their 8-seat Cessna 208s on 40-minute flights between Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Memphis, Tennessee. There's not going to be any snack or service on that flight. Obviously, A, they don't have a flight attendant, and B, just because it's a smaller route, it's a smaller aircraft. So it really just depends on, what airline you're flying on, how long the route is. American does have four essential air service contracts in the country. They fly from Philadelphia to Watertown, they fly from Chicago to Waterloo, and then they fly from Dallas to both Garden City, Kansas, and Grand Island, Nebraska. Those are longer routes on regional jets, so they will have flight attendants, they will have, snack service, they will have higher service in first class if they have first class on some of those routes. But then again, you go to smaller routes and they don't. I know Delta, they won't do a service if the flight is under a certain amount of miles. I don't remember or I don't recall what that threshold is, but I know a lot of flights to their EAS cities within Minnesota, Minneapolis to Brainerd, Minneapolis to Bemidji, a lot of those routes are under that threshold. So it's just simply a flight on an RJ, there's no service.
And typically, are the schedules and the frequencies, are they set out in the contracts? Like, is it like, do they usually fly once a day, once a week? Like, what does the service schedule usually look like for these routes?
That's a good question. Schedule, like timing wise, that's not set out in the contract. Whether you want to serve this flight at 5 a.m. or 5 p.m., that's not so much set out in the contracts. What is set out is the frequency of the flights. If you have a 30 to a 50 seat jet, The city may have 1 to 3 daily flights depending on what the city is in the day of the week. On a Saturday, they may have one flight. You know, on a Wednesday, they may have 2 or 3 flights. But then you go to cities that have 8, 9 seat propeller planes, and they get generally between, you know, 3 to 7 daily flights depending on the city. Chicago to Muskegon, Michigan, they currently fly 5 to 7 daily flights on a 8 seat Cessna 208. But then you go to places like Sholo, Arizona, and they have 2 to 3 daily flights to Phoenix on an 8-seat prop plane as well. So it all just depends on what that city's contract is requiring and what the city wants. And there are contracts that require more service than others. Like I said, the time of day is not really laid out. So you do get really nice schedules. Like you'll have an early morning departure from the EAS city, and then you'll get into the hub. And even the airlines that aren't with the major carriers, like, you know, American, Delta, United, SkyWest, they kind of line it up with the bank flights of the larger airlines. But even then, you get airlines like Southern Airways, Contour, you know, Denver Air Connection. They get that there are large bank departures at larger airports like Denver and Chicago. They will try and line up the arrivals and departures so you can connect to other cities. But then you get stuff like Ironwood, Michigan. You know, Denver Air Connection flies there. Their first departure isn't until 1:30 in the afternoon. The flight comes in from Chicago at 12:30 noon. It leaves at 12:55. That's their first flight of the day. So if you want to go anywhere in the morning, you're kind of out of luck because no flights leave the city until 12:55. So not every city has nice timing and nice schedules, but obviously the airlines do try and set it up so it's easier for the community, but it just really depends on aircraft availability.
Fair enough. Now, you've done a lot of EAS flying and regional flying. What are some of the more interesting or unique EAS routes out there, or the interesting experiences or destinations?
Oh man, I could talk about that for an hour, but I'm not going to do that to you. So I've been to 49 Essential Air Service cities. I've flown into most of them. I think there's only a couple that I haven't flown into, but I've, you know, driven to or visited, driving across country or whatever it may be. There's 3 main ones that I'm going to talk about. The first one is Alliance, Nebraska with Denver Air Connection. Up until about a year ago, the Fairchild Swearingen Metroliner. It is an older generation of aircraft. It's originally suited for 19 passengers, but they took half the seats out so that it qualifies under the certain part FAR of the regulations. So it's a 9-seat plane, but it was made for 19 seats. So first off, every seat has like 6 feet of legroom.
Oh, wow.
And I can't even reach the seat in front of me. That's hilarious. But, you know, other than that, up until recently, that was the only commercial route in the country that still operated on the Fairchild Metroliner. A lot of the employees, they call it the scare child. It's not that scary, honestly. It's a fun, it's loud as anything when you're on the outside, but when you're inside, it's not much different from any other propeller aircraft. It's definitely unique looking. If you don't know what it looks like, look it up. It looks like an extended Coke can with wings on the side. Like I said, up until recently, that was the only route in the country, but since then, Denver Air Connection has expanded their Metroliner service. They won the contract in McCook, Nebraska, so they fly from Denver to McCook, and they also won the contract in Cortez, Colorado, so they also fly from Denver to Cortez, which continues on to Phoenix. Dornier Jet is another really unique aircraft that, you know, since the 90s has really fallen out of style and out of fashion. It's a 30-seat, high-winged, high-jet aircraft. The wings on the top of the plane. The jets are under the wings, and it's a 30-seat plane. Denver Air Connection, again, they fly very unique aircraft. They fly the Dornier 328 jet, also kind of known and shortened to the DoJet. They fly that from Minneapolis to Ironwood, Michigan. And then they fly it occasionally from Denver to Clovis, New Mexico, which continues on to Dallas. So, you know, there are these unique aircraft that you're not going to find anywhere else in the country except on these essential air service routes, because for the most part, they're not going to be profitable when you're flying them without subsidy. West Yellowstone Airport, it is in Montana, southwestern, southwestern Montana. It's about 2 miles away from the western gate of the Yellowstone National Park. That park entrance is closed for most of the year. It's closed from, I believe, October until mid-May. So this is another one of those really weird EAS airports, and I believe the only one currently that has a seasonal contract. From May until October or September, they have flights to Salt Lake City under the Delta brand and Denver under the United Express brand. You know, depending on the day, it can switch and alter between them. It doesn't operate for the entire year, so it's really a route that, unless you're flying to Yellowstone and you're going to see Yellowstone, you don't know about these airports. And until recently, I'd say, 4 or 5 years ago, I didn't even know that that airport existed and that Yellowstone had an airport.
I find it super interesting how you have such a fascination and knowledge, and clearly you're very knowledgeable about the EAS. And it's one of those things where it's an essential public service out there for a reason, right? That's what the name is. And yet you've managed to find a perspective where you have an interest in it. You fly these routes out of interest, not out of necessity, like some of the people in the communities do. What is it about the EAS and small airport flying that's so interesting to you and that's ignited the passion for you?
I think it's kind of what you said. It's that necessity, not for me, obviously, because I'm doing this for fun and I don't live in these cities, but it's just so unique. Everybody has pictures and experiences and stories of flying out of airports like Los Angeles. And I kind of like the uniqueness and the aspect that you go to somewhere like Watertown, South Dakota, or you go to Hot Springs, Arkansas. There's really not that many people going there for fun, other than, to see family for fun. These routes kind of shine out as unique and one of a kind, whereas, you go in there and everybody's going to have a story of why they're taking this route. People, go through the budget and they see the Essential Air Service program and how much money is spent on it. And, people complain, oh, why do you have service to, blah, blah, blah city? And, why do you people need to fly to so and so city? They can't just drive, take a train, blah, take a bus, But the reason these routes exist is because they are essential. The logistics of living in some of these small cities, especially some of these cities out in, middle of nowhere Colorado, middle of nowhere Montana. You're, 6, 7 hours away from, a major, probably not a hospital, but like a major medical facility or, any way to get stuff in and out, especially in Alaska. It truly is essential air service, and you need the service in order not only to survive, but to move in and out of these small communities.
Joey Girardi is an aviation writer, photographer, and videographer with a special interest in the Essential Air Service and other small airlines and airports. You can find his journalism work at airlinegeeks.com and his videos on YouTube. We'll include links to those in the episode description. You can also find him on Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube under Girardi Aviation, and we'll also have links to those as well. Well, thanks again, Joey, for being here. I'm super happy that I was able to have you on, and I really appreciate you coming to share your knowledge and your passion.
Yeah, thanks. It was great talking with you. I love talking about EAS and, honestly, I wish I could talk more, but, I don't want to talk your ear off all day.
All right. Thanks, Joey. Appreciate it. That brings us to the end of this episode of Flying Smarter. Please take a minute and follow the podcast on social media, where you'll find things like extra content, podcast updates, and sneak peeks. Flying Smarter is on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn at Flying Smarter, and on Twitter at Flying_Smarter. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you again soon.